Welcome, everybody. This is the, I think it's the fourth office hours session for the Mises Academy online class, Principles of Economics. It is May 12th, 2012. And we've got George asking a question right off the bat, so why don't I go ahead and answer that. Sorry, George, just a second. My screen is really small. I'm trying to figure out. Okay. So George asks, question 7 of quiz 3, and that's closed by now, so yeah, I can talk about it, asks, according to the textbook, or so the quiz question says, according to the textbook, in the real world, why are all capitalists also entrepreneurs? Select one. So choice A was they have the same occupational category according to the IRS. B, they both seek more money. C, there's no such thing as a guaranteed investment. And so the correct answer there is C, there's no such thing as a guaranteed investment. And George, so this is George talking now. Please explain why C is correct. I went back and forth between B and C. And finally settle on B because of the phrase in the real world. Also, given the arbitrage profits of banks taking near zero interest rate loans from the Fed and investing in U.S. bonds paying a higher rate, I thought that was about as close to a can't-miss investment as one could get, at least in the short term. I didn't think there was a compelling choice for either B or C, really. Maybe I missed something in the textbook. Okay, first let me tell you why I think the answer is C and not B, and then if you want, I can try to find in the textbook where it says that, or you know what in the textbook made me think that should have been the answer you would have put. So so first of all, a capitalist is somebody who possesses financial capital. And or I mean, it could be even in a world without money, I guess you could sort of have a capitalist. But in our modern day, what we mean is somebody who invests in various lines of production. So typically we think of it in terms of money, but I guess you could also let someone use your land and you could just reckon it in terms of money and so forth. All right, so they're entrepreneurs. So what is it that an entrepreneur does? Is that the entrepreneur has to anticipate the future. And the entrepreneur is the one who takes a bunch of inputs and then combines them to make a resulting output and hopes that there's going to be sufficient consumer demand for that thing to turn a profit. Right? So that's what the entrepreneur does. So what I'm trying to get at here is the wage earner, okay? So somebody, let's say right now, decides, okay, I'm going to build a new shopping center. And so what is he draws the plans out, and he needs $10 million up front, and then he's going to use it to buy some concrete and to pay construction workers to come and hire a bunch of construction equipment and stuff like that. And they're going to dig the foundation, lay the concrete, blah, 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 build the thing, and then I don't know how long it takes to build a shopping center. 18 months from now, the thing opens up with all the stores that are in there. Then they're going to say, okay, let's hope a bunch of customers come and that these stores now, the store owners can pay me rent to rent the spaces out in the mall, and that I, the mall developer, now start earning enough rent from the store owners to justify the $10 million that I borrowed 18 months ago. Or that, you know, I went to investors and gave them pieces of my business and so forth. Okay, so what I'm saying there is, in that whole thing, the construction worker who gets paid whatever, $50,000 a year to work on building that mall, he's not, I mean, the only real risk he took in doing that is that maybe he had some better career path he could have taken. You see what I'm saying? I mean, so technically he still is an entrepreneur also, but I'm saying there's a sense in which he doesn't really care whether the mall does well or not, right? Because he got paid up front. Whether the mall tanks or whether the mall takes off, that construction worker knew what he was getting paid for his work, and he did it. Okay, and he got his wages and he walked. It's not like the person who paid him is going to come back to him 18 months from now and say, yeah, remember when I paid you for those 2 weeks back in the day when you helped dig the foundation for that mall? Well, turns out people didn't patronize the shops enough as we thought, so you got to give me some of that money back. That's not going to happen. That wasn't the nature of the deal. And the same thing for the companies that sold the concrete and the construction vehicle place that rented the equipment, if that's the way they did it. You know, all the lumber that they bought, you know, Home Depot or wherever they bought it from, they made the sale. It's a done deal. They got paid. It's over with. But the capitalists who helped finance it all are still on the hook too. So even if the entrepreneur signs a document saying, I'm going to borrow $10 million from you at 12% interest, I mean, if the thing blows up in their face and nobody shows up on grand opening and he's got no money, even if his personal assets are on the line and they can come take his house, he's not worth $10 million. So the people who invested in that are going to be out money. So the point that I was trying to get at there is, even though theoretically in terms of definitions we can distinguish between, you know, the landowner, the laborer, the capitalist, and the entrepreneur, what I was getting at is that in the real world, every capitalist who invests in an operation is also an entrepreneur because they're on the hook too, in a qualitatively more important way than the laborers or the landowners who also might be engaged in that operation as well, because the fundamental difference is the capitalists, by the nature of their relationships, they're giving the use of their property up front, hoping to get paid later. So clearly, if they're partner or if they're equity owners, right? Like if they bought a share of stock in the company, well, then clearly they're being entrepreneurial, that they're thinking that this thing's going to take off. But even if it's a debt contract where it's fixed terms, the person might default if this thing doesn't work out well. So, well, and maybe another way of seeing it is a capitalist doesn't just recklessly lend to whoever promises the highest rate of interest. The capitalist needs to look at the specific projects and proposals and say, nah, I don't think you're going to be able to pay me that. If I lent you this money, I bet you would default on this bond you want me to buy from you. So. Whereas it's not nearly as clear cut. I mean, I suppose if there's something like that too with wage earners, that you wouldn't want to like quit your current job and go move to a different city and start up with some new company that offered you twice as much money if you thought the company was going to fold. Okay. Yeah. And so choice B, right. So choice B is true. They both do seek more money, generally speaking, but that's not what makes a capitalist an entrepreneur, because the wage earner also seeks more money, but the wage earner is not as much of an entrepreneur in a given operation as much as the capitalist would be. So there is a sense in which the capitalist necessarily is always being entrepreneurial, because again he or she has to evaluate is this a good project or not, regardless of what the terms of the contract might say. And the person's like, oh no, I'm going to pay you back and then some. Well, the person won't be able to if the thing doesn't work out. Whereas just about everybody else who deals with them, it's a spot transaction and they're not nearly as much on the hook. So that's where I was going with that. Do you want me to get the textbook and to show you, or are you okay at this point? Okay. Because, I mean, for sure, whatever I just said there's a discussion like that in the text, and so that's what I had in mind with that question. Okay, I think we got a few more people who showed up, so if you guys have questions, go ahead and ask me. If you don't have a specific one off the top of your head right now, I can run through a quick supply and demand thing just for, because it's an important issue. So why don't I do that, because in case other people are listening to this later, you know, this is something that that they're going to want to hear, so I don't want to have them to have to sit through a bunch of tangential questions. So I'm going to go ahead and run this supply and demand example again. But like I say, if you guys have other questions, just go ahead and post them. All right, so let me just do the crude oil one. I think that's a pretty good representative. And then what I'm going to do on Wednesday's lecture with everybody there, I'm going to officially do the last example, which I didn't get to in week four's lecture. So what I'm doing right now is review. I'm not going to move ahead unless you guys want me to also. But right now this is review. So I already did this one. Okay. So remember the question was, you're asked, okay, all of a sudden OPEC nations announced that they're cutting back output by 200,000 barrels a day. What's going to happen to the price and quantity of crude oil in the world oil market? So the way you answer a question like that is, in this sort of class, you first just draw standard supply and demand curves and get your initial equilibrium. Okay, so I'm drawing a nice, basically 45-degree lines, because the question didn't give us any reason to think it'd be one or the other. And so you get your initial price piece, so I'm going to call it P1, and your initial Q I'm going to call it Q1. So remember, if I was going to stop at this point, I might call it P star and Q star and say those are the equilibria. But since I'm going to change stuff, and actually I should call this S1, I can call this D1 too. Since I'm going to change it, that's why I'm just putting a little 1 under everything. Okay, so now the issue is, okay, so the OPEC nations said they're going to reduce output. What happens? So the first thing we need to ask ourselves is, that change, is that something that's going to affect the supply or the demand or both? So it clearly affects supply. And the way to think that through is to say, you know, before, at the various hypothetical prices, they were going to supply a certain amount, and now it's like they're going to do 200,000 barrels less at each of those hypothetical prices. So if you were to just draw a new supply curve from scratch, it might look something like this. Okay, that's actually a pretty big drop in terms of how many barrels get pumped a day, but I want to make it easy to see stuff on the graph. So again, I don't know what's easier for you to think of. Strictly speaking, we're drawing a new supply curve, and it just so happens that it looks like we moved the first one, right? So that's why we say metaphorically, oh, supply shifted to the left. Really, that's kind of a nonsense statement. Supply is a relationship. What does it mean, shift to the left? We mean, well, if you plotted the first supply curve and the second one, it looks like you picked up the first one and moved it to the left. That's all we mean by that. Okay. So a leftward shift in supply is the same thing as saying that supply was reduced or there was a reduction in supply. Remember, graphically speaking, in terms of the artwork, you might say, well, yeah, sure, it moved left, or I could just as well say that the supply curve shifted upward, right? Because they both kind of look the same. You know, that S2 looks like it's higher than the S1. You're right. If we didn't know anything about economics and we're just worried about the graphical depiction of it, that would be an equally fine thing to say, but we don't ever say that. So I'm going to just get my eraser and erase that little arrow I just drew there, because it would be misleading. because then you would be in the position of saying supply went down and that's why we shifted the supply curve up, and then you'd get all screwed up talking like that. Whereas since we read from left to right, it does kind of make sense to say supply went down and that's why the curve shifted to the left. All right, so maybe if we read right to left, that would be confusing too. Who knows? Okay, so just I want to make sure you understand that's why we do it this way. That's why we describe it that way, because we're trying to avoid confusion. Okay, so now let's think for a second. Did demand shift? And so here is where I'm going to be real anal, and this is a point I'm going to hammer a bunch of times, and that's why I'm doing it again right now. There is a difference between demand changing versus the quantity demanded changing. All right, so don't think in terms of, oh, well, in a new equilibrium, there's going to be less oil, so people must be demanding less. That you're going to get screwed up if you think like that. What you want to remember is that demand is a relationship between hypothetical prices and the various quantities demanded at each of those hypothetical prices. So when you run through, you know, what are the various reasons that people might buy quantities of crude oil at various prices, there's all sorts of things that might be motivating that, but the behavior of the OPEC nations per se isn't really one of those things, right? So what's going to happen is, yes, of course, what the OPEC nations do is ultimately going to affect how much oil people buy. It has to. But the way it's going to do it is not by shifting the demand curve, it's just by changing the price. Okay, so I don't know if that's helping or hurting, but let me go ahead and just finish the graphical analysis and then I'll just come back again to that distinction. Okay, so if you just humor me for the moment and agree that the OPEC announcement by itself does not change consumers' willingness to buy various amounts of crude oil at different prices, then you say, okay, so yes, supply shifted, but the demand curve didn't change. So that means now the new equilibrium is right here, where S2 intersects the original S1 diagram. And so to find the new price, it's this thing right here, P2. And the new quantity is right here, which is Q2. Okay, so notice that the price went up, P2 was higher than P1, and the quantity went down. Oops, I just did something. Blew the whole screen somehow. Okay, so, and that's going to be true in general. In general, if demand stays the same and supply goes down, then the new equilibrium, the price is going to be higher and the quantity demand is going to be lower, or the quantity supplied, because they're both the same. Okay, so let's come back to this distinction. What happened to demand in this example? It's not true to say that demand went down. What is correct to say is that the quantity demanded went down, because to say demand went down means the demand curve shifted, and as you can see, it didn't shift. So this is really what the whole point of doing a supply and demand framework is. Because remember, what we're doing with these curves, we're not offering a theory. It's like a tautology. All these curves mean is that we're saying, hold everything else constant, and now tell me on the supply curve how many units the suppliers will bring to market if we're changing the price of the thing, holding everything else constant. And then with the demand side, we're saying, you know, hold everything else constant except the price of this particular good or service, and we change that, and that's what the demand curve traces out. Okay, so when we say that in this example the demand curve didn't move, what we're getting at is that the OPEC announcement, sure, it affected how much oil people end up buying, right? Because originally people bought Q1 units, and now they're only buying Q2, and Q2 is less than Q1. So yes, that there is a sense in which the OPEC announcement affected the demand side, but the way it affected it was by raising prices, right? Because the OPEC nations, when they cut back, prices ended up being higher. And so it was the high price that made people buy less oil. All right, so that's the crucial distinction. So if since it was the high price doing it, then that's being described as being on the, you know, the original demand schedule, because the original demand schedule said at various hypothetical prices how many units of crude oil would the consumers want to buy. So the fact that they're buying fewer units now because the price went up, that's still consistent with the same original demand schedule. That's what demand is. It says at various prices. So a change in price just moves you along that original demand schedule. So that's the way to make the distinction. There's different ways of saying it. You could call it a change in demand. Versus change in quantity demanded, all right, so that's one way to make this distinction. Or another way to make it is to say that the demand curve moved. All right, so this thing is equal to saying demand curve moved. Okay, so I'm going to put a circle around these two phrases. So those are interchangeable. That's an equal sign right there. So to say the demand curve moved is the same thing as saying there was a change in demand. And those are different concepts from saying, that's this versus is doing, that there was a change in the quantity demanded, or another way of saying it is, so I'll put an equal sign, movement along the demand curve. Okay, and so I'll put a little circle around those two phrases to show that they're grouped together. Okay, so let me belabor this one last time here. Originally, we were at this intersection, right? And that was at Q1. So at the in the original equilibrium, before OPEC made the announcement, quantity supplied and quantity demanded were at this level Q1. Let me just call it 80 million barrels. Now in the new equilibrium, quantity is lower. So both the quantity supplied and the quantity demanded is lower. Let's just call it 79 million barrels. Okay, and these numbers aren't consistent with what I said before, but I'm just trying to put some specific numbers. Okay, So remember, in equilibrium, quantity supplied has to equal quantity demanded. That's what we mean by equilibrium. So both the quantity, both the supply side and the demand side went down, if that's the way you want to think about it, from the first equilibrium to the second equilibrium. Suppliers are bringing fewer units to market. They're only bringing 79 million barrels as opposed to 80. And the consumers are buying fewer units. They're only buying 79 million, whereas before they bought 80. Okay? So, but as economists now, by having this supply and demand framework, we can explain what happened. We can sort of say which side of the market caused the change. And so what we're going to say is, oh, supply went down, or supply was reduced, so there was a change in supply. The supply curve itself moved. You can see, just look at this diagram. When we're trying to understand why did we move from the first intersection point to the second intersection point, you know, to the was that Northwest. Why did that happen? It's crystal clear from this diagram because supply shifted and demand did not shift. We're still using that same D1 demand curve. So what the way to talk about this is to say the supply curve shifted left, supply itself changed, and then we moved along the original demand curve. The quantity demanded also changed because the price went up. So again, let me just say one last time, to explain what happened here, you would say, as a real anal economist, so there was a reduction in supply, meaning the whole supply curve shifted left. Demand stayed the same, but now at the higher equilibrium price, we moved along the original demand curve so that the quantity demanded went down also. All right, so you can see, you know, this arrow that I drew here was showing the whole supply curve moving, whereas, you know, we could draw an arrow right here showing we're moving along that original demand curve. And so if we're careful and precise when we describe it like that, we're not going to get all tied up in the knots like that hypothetical newscaster who would say, oh, OPEC cut production, so prices went up, but then at the high prices, demand went down, but then since demand went down, prices went down, and then you're just walking around in a circle. No, here it's crystal clear. Supply went down, prices went up, and because of the high prices, the quantity demanded was reduced. Let's see, then that's the end of the argument. That's the, you know, I don't then say, oh, and because quantity demanded went down, therefore there was downward pressure prices. No, 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 because moving along a demand curve doesn't have anything to do with pushing prices. Changes in prices are what makes you move along the demand curve. All right? So that's how you would do that particular one. And again, I'm just really hammering home those distinctions between a movement of the entire curve versus a movement along the curve. And if you can keep those distinctions straight, it'll really help you analyzing various scenarios. Okay, you guys have any questions? Or so it doesn't have to be about this stuff. I can field generic questions too. We got about 25 minutes left. Let me then go ahead and run through something. So in general, so what I just did there, I'm going to put up a bunch of these real quick. So that was what? A reduction in supply. So in general, yeah, S1, D1, and then the supply goes down. In general, you're going to have prices going up. And quantity going down. All right, that's always going to happen unless you've got some really crazy looking supply and demand curves. But in general, if you've got a supply curve that's obeying the law of supply, right, it's upward sloping, and the same and demand curve is downward sloping that obeys the law of demand, and then you draw a new supply curve that's to the left, it's got to be intersecting that demand curve to the left and above, to the northwest. And so it's got to be the case that P2 is higher than P1 and Q2 is lower than Q1. If you now talk about an increase in supply, it's the opposite. Well, demand stays the same. So there's supply one, there's demand one. So now what if I say increase in supply? So I'm shifting the supply curve to the right. So S2 is to the right of S1. What would happen? Well, you can see, so there's the original intersection. Now here's the new one, P1. You can see that P2 is going to be lower than P1 would have been or was. And then here's Q1, and there's Q2, and Q2 is higher. Okay, so in general, if supply increases while demand stays the same, then in the new equilibrium, prices will be lower and quantity will be higher. So here, what happened in this new scenario? We would say supply increased, demand stayed the same, we moved along the original demand curve to the higher quantity demanded. So what was the causal mechanism? For some reason, supply increased. Like if we're talking about oranges, and there was really good weather and lots of nice rainfall and sunshine, and all of a sudden we get more oranges available, well then the orange sellers at various possible prices for oranges are just going to have physically more oranges. So probably they're going to sell more, regardless of what the price is. So that means the whole supply curve now is higher. And so graphically, it looks like it moved to the right. And now the demand curve, though, is unaffected by that. People aren't more anxious to go eat oranges because it's sunny out or because it's raining a lot. You see how that works? But it is true, clearly, the fact there are more oranges physically available, yeah, there's got to be some way in the economic system that gives us the result that consumers end up buying more oranges, right? I mean, it would be kind of a crazy economic system if that didn't happen. If there's more oranges available, you want consumers to eat more. So how did that happen? Well, because the price goes down. So that's the trigger that gets consumers to eat more oranges. That's the way the market system lets them know, hey, oranges, you know, aren't as scarce as they used to be, if you want to talk like that. And so the way we do it graphically is to say the supply curve shifted to the right, and then in the new equilibrium, prices were lower, the price for a pound of oranges, and now because the price was lower, consumers with their original demand schedule, you know, their preferences for oranges haven't changed, but now oranges are cheaper than they used to be. So that's why people naturally go buy more of them. And so that's why in the new equilibrium, since there are more oranges physically available, the consumers end up going to the grocery store and putting more oranges in their cart and buying more oranges. Not because they all of a sudden, you know, people got pregnant and they have these weird cravings at 3 a.m. like, oh my gosh, I really want some oranges. That's not what's going on here. It's they're shopping and they say, oh, oranges are pretty cheap this week. I'm going to buy a bunch of them. That's the causal mechanism. Okay, so let me show you what would the difference be. Suppose we can get people in the market economy to buy more oranges because they have a genuine change in their preferences. So let's say, you know, that Surgeon General comes out and he has some new thing like, oh my gosh, if you eat 3 oranges a day, you won't get cancer. And then even Mark Sisson says the same thing, and he's doing his podcast, and Tom Woods on Facebook is like, oh my gosh, I've been eating 3 oranges a day and I'm looking like Captain America. This is crazy. So everybody across the country is all of a sudden wanting to eat three oranges a day. So now what happened? How would you explain it? But the sunshine and the rainfall are the same as they always were. So now what happens? Okay, so the way you would deal with that, as always, you would draw an original supply and demand frame curve. So you know, I've got my PQ. So here's S1, and here's B1, and here's Q1. And there's P1, and actually I'm going to erase these generic P and Qs just because they're going to get in my way. All right, so that's the original. And then again, all these cultural icons like Tom Woods and the Surgeon General and Mark Sisson and everybody are just raving about how their lives are totally different because they start eating 3 oranges a day. So now what happens? Okay, so here, but again, the sunshine and whatever is the same. So clearly the demand for oranges went up. So we'll draw this new demand curve here. So graphically looking at it, it's like we just picked up that demand curve and pulled it to the right. So demand shifted to the right. So it's not merely the quantity demand that changed, it's the whole demand curve moved. At the same price of oranges, people would be buying more oranges. Even if prices are a little bit higher, they might end up buying more oranges. Okay, so that's what it means to shift that demand curve. It's that all at these hypothetical prices, people are going to buy more oranges now than they would have before Tom Woods and Mark Sisson and all these guys were raving about oranges. So that's why when you plot the two curves together, it looks like the D2 one is to the right. All right. So make sure you get that. I mean, because this stuff is going to seem like alchemy to you if you don't understand what these curves mean. Okay. And for people who like graphing and geometry and trigonometry and doing XY planes and stuff for fun, this is going to seem like child's play to you. But for people that it's difficult for, you know, you want to get stuck on the economics here. You don't want to get tripped up just on the graphing of a function. So just make sure you get why it would be, graphically speaking, that if people now want to buy more oranges because they think oranges are better for them, that it would look like a new demand curve that was to the right. So just make sure that makes sense to you, because that should be making total sense to you. Okay, but now you say, would the supply curve move because of this new craze? And you think through the sorts of things that would affect how many oranges orange growers would be willing to bring to market at various hypothetical prices. So if oranges are $3 a pound, and the farmers all knew that, and then they said, well, gee, how much do I want to plant? You know, how much fertilizer am I going to devote to this? Da-da-da-da-da-da. The fact that there's a health craze and people want to buy a ton of oranges, would that make them change their planting decision or how much they end up bringing to market if the price of oranges is still $3 per pound? See, that's the way you got to think to understand, is the supply curve going to move? And the answer is no. What the orange growers care about is the price they're getting, you know, holding things like rainfall, sunshine, the price of fertilizer constant, those sorts of things. The only reason they would care about the health craze is that they think that's going to ultimately mean a higher price per pound of oranges. So yes, in the real world, if they heard, you know, Mark Sisson comes out with a brand new book, you know, Oranges for a Healthy Body or something like that, then, you know, he'd probably have a clever title like I've Got a Crush on Oranges or something. Yeah, they would probably just go like, oh my gosh, we're going to plant more. But the reason is that they would be anticipating that the price is going to be higher. Okay, it's not that they actually care about oranges' effects on the body in their role as farmers who might be planting oranges or they might plant apples or something else. It's a business decision. Okay, so the way in the market economy then, but we do want farmers to plant more oranges, and we want them to bring more oranges to market. But how does that manifest itself in the market economy? Well, at the higher demand, the new price is up here. Right? So this was the original one. So at the new intersection, with supply curve being the same, the demand shifted to the right. So now in the new intersection, we've got P2 is up here. So P2 is higher than P1. And Q2 is here. It's higher than Q1. So we did get the result we were hoping for. It sort of makes sense that if you're in original equilibrium and all of a sudden everybody wants to buy more oranges to eat them, you would want the market economy to sort of accommodate that new information, those preferences, that it should sort of re-equilibrate, reconfigure, rebalance itself. So now more resources are being channeled into the production of oranges. And that is what happens. But the mechanism is prices have to be higher. Now consumers have to be willing to pay more for oranges than they were before in order to give the farmers an incentive to plant more oranges and to cut back on other stuff that they're doing. All right, so that's so that's what would happen. Now look at, and so this is true in general. In general, if you have demand shifting to the right and supply staying the same, then in the new equilibrium, the price is going to be higher than it was before, and the quantity is going to be higher. But look at these two scenarios here. They were both, in the stories I told, they were both talking about oranges. And in both of the scenarios, orange production ended up increasing. More oranges were produced, brought to market, and bought by consumers in both of those stories that I told you. But in the first story, the cause, the thing that made the production go up, was that we said, oh, there was really nice weather. There was a lot of sunshine, a lot of rain, and so it was just physically easier. They had a bumper crop of oranges that year. The farmers had more oranges than they normally do at harvest time. And so in that scenario, the way the market deals with that and gives us the normal intuitive outcome that more oranges are brought to market and consumers buy all the oranges and they'll just let them rot, is that the price ends up going down, right? Because the consumers in that first story, it's not like they like oranges more than they did before. It's not like they read, you know, the blog post by Mark Sisson or the Facebook status update from Tom Woods talking about how green oranges are. They like oranges, you know, they liked oranges just fine before. And so how are you going to get them to now buy a lot more oranges? The price has to go down. And notice the farmers aren't mad about that. The farmers are perfectly happy to sell more oranges at a given price because the weather was so much better. You see, so no one's getting hurt there. The farmers, you know, their cup runneth over. Like, oh my gosh, I got all these oranges, so I can sell, I can afford to lower my price to get rid of these things. You know, I get more money selling them than if I just let them rot, so I might as well lower the unit price and sell more oranges. Okay, whereas in the second scenario, this, you know, the third diagram, but the second orange story that I was telling you, again, we're getting the outcome of more oranges brought to market and consumers buying more oranges in the new equilibrium, but the cause here was from the demand side. There was no change in the weather, so the farmers, you know, to get them to be willing to plant more and to bring more oranges to market, they're going to have the price go up. And so why does that happen? Well, because the consumers are willing to pay more for a given quantity of oranges, or what's the same thing, for a given price, now they're going to try to buy more. And so you put those two facts together, and that means the new equilibrium, the price is higher and the quantity is larger. Okay, I think we've got a question. Russell asks me, could you, in theory, plot the demand schedule along the demand curve? I'm not sure. Let me say what the way I would normally answer that, Russell, but then I might be misunderstanding your question. So obviously chime in again if I'm missing you. When we plot the demand curve, we are plotting the demand schedule. That's what we're doing. All right, so let me clear this stuff up. All right, so if it's like, you know, Jennifer's demand schedule, oops, and so it's a P and a Q, and so it's like, oh, at $7, she buys 0 gallons, and at $6 a gallon, she buys 0, and at $5, she buys 1 gallon, and at $4, she buys two. And at $3 a gallon, she buys eight. At $2 a gallon, she buys 10. And at one, she buys 15. So that's her demand schedule. And now if you're saying, could you plot that along the demand curve? Yeah. Not only could you, but that is what we're doing. So when we draw the demand curve, we're saying here are the prices and here are the quantities. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. So that's $7. That's $1. And then this, I got to go up to 15. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. So that's one, that's 15. So we got a 7-0, so that's this. A 6-0, that's this. A 5-1, so that's like right there. A 4-2, that's right there. A 3-8, it's like, where is it? Like right there, I think. A 2-10, and a 1-15. And then if you connect those, all right, so it's an ugly looking thing, but that is the demand curve for Jennifer if we connect all those points. Okay, so that is what we're doing. That's why I started with the demand schedule at first, is because I wanted you guys to really understand, because yeah, when we draw a demand curve, like I said, we either draw a nice smooth thing, or what we end up really doing is just drawing a straight line. We put a little D next to it and say, oh, there's the demand curve. But what you need to understand is that is a relationship. This is really what you should be thinking about when you think of demand. It is a relationship. It's a whole set of different pairs of numbers. One number being the price, and the other number being the quantity demanded at that price, right? So it's these pairs. It's this whole relationship that is demand. It's not just some particular element in this list. The whole list is the demand. And so that's why when you say, did demand change, what you mean is, did any of these numbers in here change? We don't mean, did you move from one line on the demand schedule to another line because the price changed? That's not a change in the demand schedule. If the demand schedule changed, then you would have to be crossing out some of these numbers and writing other ones. So if you're just moving along the demand curve in terms of the demand schedule, that just means, you know, like if price originally was $5 and the person was, you know, and Jennifer bought one gallon of gas, and now I tell you the price goes down to 3 and she buys 8 gallons of gas, you know, in terms of her demand, the demand curve would move. She moved from this point down to what, this point. So she moved along the demand curve. And in terms of the schedule, it just means she moved from this line and now she's down on this line. But you wouldn't have changed any of these numbers. Whereas if we're doing the example of the oranges, when Mark Sisson and Tom Wood start touting orange consumption, then you would have to go in and just change the numbers, right? So you wouldn't just be moving from one level to another on the schedule. You would have to cross out all these numbers in the right column and write in new numbers, and the numbers would be bigger because you'd be saying now at various hypothetical prices for oranges, people want to buy more oranges than they did before. So that's why the whole demand schedule changed, meaning if you go and graph that thing now, it's going to look visually like you moved it to the right. Okay, George Smith asks me. George apparently has had enough of graphing demand curves. He says, generic question, what do you think of David Stockman's investing advice, A, B, C, D? Anything Bernanke cannot A, B, C, D, which is an acronym for anything Bernanke cannot destroy. Yeah, I haven't read his analysis, so I'm not giving a blanket endorsement to anything David Stockman might have said about this, but yeah, from you just putting that funny line down there, that is something that I agree with. I'm in terms of me advise, like, you know, if I have relatives or something who are asking me, and it's awkward because if you tell somebody something and it doesn't work, then if it's a relative, you're going to see him at Thanksgiving, and it's like a little bit awkward, you know. But what I've basically been doing is just telling people to play defense. So rather than me saying, oh, this is what I think you want to do, and you're going to be rich 5 years from now, it's more I'm thinking, these are all the things that could terribly go wrong and could blow you up and just wipe you out. So here's the way I would structure things so that in any one of these terrible outcomes, you're at least not going to be devastated. Right? That's kind of the way I've been telling people to think about it. And so, yeah, one of the things that could happen is tomorrow, well, it wouldn't be tomorrow because it's a weekend, but Monday, the dollar could crash. And people don't think that's possible, but of course it's possible. And, you know, if that happened, interest rates would zoom way up. Barrel of oil, from our perspective, could cost $300 just overnight. That could happen if the dollar just literally crashed against other currencies. That could happen. And so in that sort of environment, you would see the price of imports would all shoot way up, right? So things at Walmart all of a sudden wouldn't be cheap. So it wouldn't just be gasoline that would be expensive. It would be all the stuff that we import from abroad. And all that would be expensive. So that would be like price inflation, but I think U.S. companies would be in trouble in that scenario too. So just having a bunch of stock wouldn't be great. So in a situation like that, you would want gold and silver. But on the other hand, I know there's a lot of people associated with the Austro-Libertarian movement that basically have everything in gold and silver, or at least that's the impression you get from talking to them. But I also think that's risky too, because I mean, let's face it, those of us who were worried about what Bernanke's been doing leading to massive price inflation, things haven't yet manifested themselves the way we are warning people they could. You know what I'm saying? So I don't think it's because we were wrong in the grand scheme of things. And yes, there's all sorts of prices that are way higher than they should be, and the Keynesian analysis doesn't make any sense either. But it is true that we've sort of been in this rut for a few years now without seeing prices just absolutely explode. And so at this point, might we be in this kind of rut for another 5 years? Maybe. I don't know. I'm surprised it's been this long. It's sort of like, I think investors just, I can't believe they're still paying such prices for U.S. treasuries and so forth. I think a lot of it has to do with Europe and whatever. But be that as it may, the point is prices are not zooming through the roof on standard consumer goods the way I thought was possible when Bernanke first started doing the crazy stuff he's been doing. So I still think that's baked into the cake, and that we're not going to be able to avoid that without him just sucking out all that money from the financial system and absolutely blowing up the financial sector. But the point is, we might be in this sluggish equilibrium for another 5-10 years even. And so I think, you know, you don't want to just have everything in gold and silver, especially like if you're retired and you need income. And so I actually don't think it's that bad to have some of your portfolio in bonds. If you don't want to own government bonds on principle, okay, and then, you know, corporate bonds, stuff like that. So I do think corporate bonds are going to get crushed, but the point is not putting all your eggs in one basket. Like, you're going to have gold and silver to to cover yourself in that scenario, in the scenario where your corporate bonds get destroyed. But for people who need income, you can't just live off gold and silver for the next 10 years. So anyway, that's, I think he's probably generally right, and my general philosophy has been to tell people just play defense and make sure that in each of these three scenarios of, you know, massive price inflation, the dollar collapses tomorrow, you're not going to get wiped out. What if we're like this with, you know, awful unemployment, the economy's just terrible, because you don't want to own a bunch of equity if things are like this for the next 10 years, because profits are going to be terrible. I mean, there's no real economic growth. This is just awful. And so if things were going to be like this for the next 10 years, you probably want to have very safe bonds to at least get some income. And then, you know, and then I even assign and say, well, and what's the other possibility? Say, hey, it's possible that, you know, these Keynesian guys are right. And maybe we will just gradually grow out of this and we won't blow up. And in that scenario, you'd probably want to have a bunch of stuff in equity. And then, you know, the precious metals would collapse once people got over the panic, like they did in the early 80s. You know, gold and silver prices collapsed back then. Interest rates rose. And the stock market took off like a rocket. So if you think that might happen, then you also want to have exposure to. So I'm not really saying anything extraordinary. It's just, it's like I said, the way I'm picturing things is just who the heck knows what's going to happen at this point. And just you want to make sure you're not assuming things are going to go one way and then you get wiped out if they go the other way, as opposed to, you know, being real happy with your investment strategy because you think you're going to be rich. That's not the way I'm thinking about stuff right now. Okay, well, I got to stop there, guys. Thanks for tuning in, and I will see you on Wednesday.